This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stephen Sondheim's musical Merrily We Roll Along ran for only 16 performances after opening on Broadway in 1981. So for fans of the show, like me, a revival is cause for celebration. The show is currently being performed for a 2-week run as part of the Encore series Great American Musicals in Concert at New York City Center. We're going to listen back to excerpts of two interviews from 2010 in which Sondheim talked about that show and his songwriting process. Merrily We Roll Along is about three good friends, two young songwriters and a fiction writer, who are eager to make their mark. The story shows how they change over the course of 25 years. One character, composer Franklin Shepard, heads in a commercial direction which ruins the friendships and turns him cynical and self-centered. The story is told chronologically in reverse, so it starts with bitterness and ends with the idealism of youth. The best-known songs from the show are Old Friends, Not a Day Goes By, and Good Thing Going. Stephen Sondheim, welcome back to Fresh Air. You say that people assume that a lot of your songs are really autobiographical, but they're not, with the exception of Opening Doors from your 1981 show Merrily We Roll Along. And I saw a revival of the show a few years ago. It didn't last long, sadly, on Broadway. But I saw a revival by the York Theater Company.
Yes.
It was wonderful. I love the show, and I love the songs from the show. So I want to play Opening Doors, and then I want to talk a little bit about it. And
okay.
Do you want to describe where the song fits into the story?
The idea of the show is to go, as the listeners may not know, go backwards in time from a very successful group of 40-year-olds or 45-year-olds and take them back to their very youthful days before they compromised their principles. It goes backwards in time. It's based on a George Kaufman Moss Hart play. The song takes place over a period of 2 years in the lives of the three leading players. Two of them are songwriters, a lyricist and a composer, and their best friend is a young woman who is a budding novelist. And it's the three of them trying to break into, well, the two guys into show business, and she's trying to finish writing a book.
So this song is at the point where they're kind of hoping to become real,
That's
real
right.
Composer,
yeah,
a real lyricist, and a real
they're
novelist.
Opening doors.
They're opening
they're knocking
doors.
On doors.
And we're
going to
hear this song by, in the original cast recording, sung by Jim Walton, Lonnie Price, and the part of the producer who interjects in the middle here will be sung by Jason Alexander, who played George on Seinfeld. So
right.
Here we go from Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along.
Bum, bum, ba, da, 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 da. How's it coming?
Good, you?
Done.
1 minute.
Amber Gavin.
Hi.
Mary.
Say hello.
I've got another job.
Where? What's that?
A brand new card to pop up picture.
What about the book?
What about the book?
Did you give the publisher the book?
Yes,
good.
No.
Mary.
Finished.
Let me call you back.
Bye. This is just a draft.
Right.
Probably it stinks.
Right.
I haven't had the time to do a polish.
Will you sing?
Right. Who wants to live in New York? Who wants the worry, the noise, the dirt, the heat? Who wants the garbage cans clanging in the street? Suddenly I do. They're always popping their cork. I hate that line. The cops, the cabbies, the sales girls up at Saks. You gotta have a real taste for maniacs. Suddenly I do.
That's great. That's swell. The other stuff as well. It isn't every day I hear a score this strong. The fellas, if I may, there's only one thing wrong. There's not a tune you can hum. There's not a tune, you go bum, 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 da dum. You need a tune to go bum, 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 da dum. Give me a melody. Or can't you throw them a crumb? What's wrong with letting them tap their toes a bit? I'll let you know when Stravinsky has a hit. Give me some melody. Ah, sure, I know. It's not that kind of show. But can't you have a score that's sort of in between? We'll play a little more, I'll show you what I mean.
Wants to live in New York. I always hated the dirt, the heat, the noise, but ever since I met you, I...
Listen, boys, maybe it's me, but that's just not a hum of a mum of a mum of a melody. Write more work hard, leave your name with a girl. Less avant-garde, leave your name with a girl. Just write a plain old melody.
Opening Doors from Merrily We Roll Along by my guest, Stephen Sondheim, who said this is his really autobiographical song. So is the part autobiographical where the producer complains that it's not a song you can hum, give me a melody?
Sure. But that, it's autobiographical in the general sense. It's, you know, first of all, I didn't have a collaborator. I mean, it's not specifically autobiographical. I wrote my own lyrics, my own music. And the girl is merely an amalgam of people like, particularly, I was very close to Mary Rogers, Dick Rogers' daughter. She became a composer as well as a novelist, as a matter of fact. And of course, Hal Prince, who was a producer and then eventually a director. And we were all very close to each other. It's not specifically based on us, but it's on the ambience of our lives and the speed and the excitement and the disappointment and the triumph, etc. The whole business of hummability, of course, has to do with familiarity. If you hear a tune enough times, you'll hum it. You know, you can. First time I heard the Berg Violin Concerto, I thought, what is this noise? And the third time I heard it, I thought, oh, that's interesting. And the fifth time I heard it, I was humming along with it. And I remember being at the intermission of A Little Night Music when it first came out and hearing somebody say, oh, that Weekend in the Country, that's such a catchy tune. Well, you know, no, very few people accused me of writing catchy tunes. And of course it was a catchy tune. She just heard 11 choruses of it. And so, of course, she could hum it.
Now, the producer sings, I'll Let You Know When Stravinsky Has a Hit. He sings mm-hmm. sarcastically. Now, you studied with the avant-garde composer Milton Babbitt.
Mm-hmm.
When you studied with him, was your ambition Broadway, or was it more...
Oh, no, I always wanted to write songs. Well, he's a songwriter manqué. I wanted to learn compositional technique, and that's what I learned from him. But we would spend... We had four-hour sessions once a week, and we would spend the first hour analyzing songs by, Jerome Kern or by De Silva Brown and Henderson, the classic songs of the American theater and American movies, and we spent an hour, on, songs, and then 3 hours on Beethoven and Bach. And it was all about essentially compositional analysis. But I only wanted to write songs. I didn't want to write concert music.
Can you give me an example of an insight you got from Babbitt studying, say, a Jerome Kern song?
One of the things we analyzed in detail, one of the songs, was All the Things You Are, which has a remarkable harmonic structure in it. Which, among other things, consists of the fact that the tonic chord isn't played until the end of the song, and it goes from a circle of fifths and then breaks the circle of fifths with a tritone, which echoes itself not only in the melody but also in the bass and defines both the key that the song is written in and the key to which it's going, etc., etc., etc. I've actually reproduced that hour-long analysis he gave me to students I had at Oxford when I taught at Oxford, and it's as lodged in my mind because it is a way of approaching when you're trying to hold a song together, how you hold it together harmonically and still make it fresh. Kern was a master at that.
Let's hear another song from the show. This is Good Thing Going. Now, this is the finished version of the song we heard excerpted earlier within the song Opening Doors, when two characters perform their song for a Broadway producer who rejected it as not hummable. We'll hear Adam Heller and Malcolm Getz, who starred in the 1994 revival of Merrily by the York Theatre Company.
It started out like a song. We started quiet and slow, with no surprise. And then one morning I woke to realize we had a good thing going. It's not that nothing went wrong. Some angry moments, of course, but just a few, and only moments, no more, because we knew we had this good thing going. And if I wanted too much, was that such a mistake at the time? You never wanted enough, all right, tough. I don't make that a crime.
back to this idea of opening doors. What were some of the first doors you knocked on before actually getting to Broadway and writing lyrics for West Side Story?
Well, I played for an awful lot of people. I remember once playing for a guy named Cy Feuer, who was one of the producers of Guys and Dolls. He'd also been a musician and was head of a music department at Universal. And I remember he criticized me for having too many B-flats in a melody. I remember he said that, and I thought, gee whiz, what is he talking about? I mean, you know, he wanted to show me that he knew a lot about music is what it was. And he might have been right, but I don't think he was. And I played for a number of producers and directors, and generally was dismissed. I snuck in through the back door. I snuck in through West Side Story, where there were the big guys there, Leonard Bernstein and Arthur Lawrence and Jerry Robbins. So it was their problem to get the show on, and believe me, it was not an easy show to get on.
Did you learn anything working with Bernstein and watching him work?
Oh, sure, a great deal. Mainly I learned something about courage. I learned Lenny was never afraid to make big mistakes. He was never afraid to fall off the top rung of the ladder. And I learned by implication that the worst thing you can do is fall off a low rung. If you're going to make a mistake, make a huge one.
Now, you've talked about George Gershwin and Harold Arlen as great influences on you, and they were both very influenced by jazz. Did you listen to much jazz or pop when you were in your formative years?
Nope, I didn't, and I'm not very influenced by jazz. First of all, the whole idea of jazz is improvisation and instrumentalists, and because I'm only a piano player and have never played in a band, I don't have a feeling for that. Also, I think by nature I'm too conservative. I only improvise at the piano when I'm writing a song by myself. I never improvise for anybody else or in front of anybody else or at a party or anything like that. And I don't think I would be good at it. I'm much too constrained. It's partly my training. I was my first music teacher, was a professor at Williams College, who was a very, very kind of Mary Poppins kind of teacher with, you know, he laid down the rules, and that appealed to me a lot, the idea of rules of how you write music, that is to say, what music consists of, that it's not just sitting and waiting for an inspiration, but that you take a melodic idea that you have that might be an inspiration, but then you develop it, and you work with it, and work it out. You don't just fiddle around at the piano to do it. And that appealed to me a lot, but that's very conscious composition, and that's also what I studied with Milton Babbitt. And that is the reverse of jazz. In fact, it's always struck me so odd that Milton, who is so knowledgeable about composition and composes according to a set of rules, some of which he makes up himself, is also such a jazz fan. I can never put those two things together. At any rate, no, I was not influenced by jazz. I was influenced by Gershwin's and Kern's and Arlen's songs, and particularly by their use of harmony.
There's a beautiful song in Merrily that's sung twice, and I'm thinking of Not a Day Goes By, and both mm-hmm. versions, each version has a different meaning, because mm-hmm. one's at the beginning of a love affair, and the other's mm-hmm. during a divorce.
Right.
Can you talk about writing that song with two different meanings in mind?
Well, I wrote the whole score knowing that it was going to go backwards in time, and I thought, what does that imply? Well, it implies that something that you and I sing today, 20 years from now, will have a different meaning to both of us. It doesn't have to be that we get divorced. Maybe it'll be memories of something. But everything that happens at a given time in your life has echoes and resonances afterwards, what I would call like reprises, really, of thoughts, of moments in your life that happen in different contexts. So I thought, if I'm going to write the show that goes backwards in time, we'll start with the reprises. That is to say, start with the variation on the theme, and then go back to the theme. And that's what happens here. It happens with a lot of other songs in the show, too. But this one, very specifically with the lyric, because it applies to two very distinct and distinctly defined situations, one a divorce and one when they got married. So you're taking two high spots of their lives, their marriage and their divorce.
So we'll hear both versions of "Not a Day Goes By" from the 1994 York Theater revival.
But that's the way to illustrate it.
Yeah.
Not a day goes by, not a single day, but you're somewhere a part of my life, and it looks like you'll stay as the days go by. I keep thinking, when does it end? Where's the day I'll have started forgetting? But I just go on thinking and sweating and cursing and crying and turning and reaching and waking and dying, and no, not a day goes by, not a blessed day, but you're still somehow part of my life, and you won't go away, so there's hell to pay, and until I die, I'll die day after day after day after day after day after day after day, till the days go by. You're somewhere a part of my life, and it looks like you'll stay
as the days go by. I keep thinking, when does it end?
That it can't get much better, much longer, but it only gets better and stronger and deeper and nearer
and simpler and freer and richer and clearer, and no, not a day goes by,
not a blessed day, but you somewhere come into my life, don't go away,
and I have to say, if you do, I'll die. I want day after 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 day till the days go by.
That's Not a Day Goes By from the 1994 York Theatre Company revival of Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along. We heard Ann Bobby, Malcolm Getz, and Amy Ryder. Our guest is Stephen Sondheim. Now, another question about your formative years. You went to a Quaker school, but you also went to the New York Military Academy.
Yeah, that was earlier.
I can't imagine you being a cadet. And I know there's also an emphasis on athletics at the school. I went on the website, and it said all cadets must participate in sports throughout the year. So what was it like
First of all, I went when I was 10 years old.
Oh,
and
okay.
10 and 11 years yeah. old. Only those 2 years. So I think you may have the wrong picture. I mean, it was also because my parents had just divorced, and military school was always considered a place to send kids of divorced parents. A lot of my classmates were kids of divorced parents, and it was a lifesaver, because your life becomes chaotic suddenly when your parents split up, and military school is bringing order to chaos. You have to be at a certain place at a certain time. You have to polish the buttons on the uniform. You have to parade here. You have to take orders there, and it was wonderful. There's a sense of structure, and I think psychologically it must have saved my life.
You know, that actually really fits into what you were talking about wanting rules and structure in music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Order out of chaos. Order out of chaos. That's why I like crossword puzzles. Order out of chaos.
Right, right, right.
I think that's what art's about anyway. I think that's why people make art.
To create order in a world
chaos,
that's chaotic.
Yeah. the world has always been chaotic. Life is unpredictable. There is no form. And making forms gives you solidity. I think that's why people paint paintings and take photographs and write music and tell stories that have beginning, middles, and ends, even when the middle is at the beginning and the beginning is at the end.
Can we talk a little bit about your process of songwriting? When you're writing at the piano, are you recording what you're playing, or are you just like
never
notating
no,
it?
No, just notating.
Mm-hmm.
There's the process of putting something down on paper is very important, I think, in keeping the stuff alive in your head. You have to make, even if you're just improvising, you have to make little decisions just to put it down on paper. You can improvise a phrase, and as you're putting it down and play it again, you may think, wait a minute, that A flat, that doesn't sound right. And you change things as you go along, even though you're just sketching. It's precisely what an artist does, when a painter does, or somebody who draws, when he sketches. When you look at, the sketch pads of anybody, Michelangelo or Leonardo, and see how they experiment with, a horse's head or a hand or something like that, that's precisely the analogy. You're putting, a finger on the, or a hand on the music paper before you try to work out a whole body.
Now, when you're working with rhyme, what's your process for figuring out options for rhyming words?
Oh, well, what you use rhyming dictionaries, what you do, and the important thing is to get the thought first, to know what you want to say. And then how you want to phrase what you want to say. And then as the music develops, you'll start to improvise a rhyme scheme or to sense a rhyme scheme. And then if you say, all right, I've got this line that ends with day, and I want to say she loves him. So how will I? And then you go through the rhyming dictionary. And I say rhyming dictionaries are useful for rhymes like day. They're not useful for trick rhymes. Those you just think up, But there are so many rhymes for day, and you want something that will somehow encompass or pinpoint what you want to say. There's a rhyme right there. About this situation. And I use a particular rhyming dictionary called the Clement Wood, which the advantage of which is that all the rhymes are listed vertically instead of horizontally. So your eye sweeps up and down the page until a word catches it. The problem with rhyming dictionaries that list things horizontally is that your eye tends, because you start to get impatient, to skip over the words. But when your eye goes up and down a page, you don't skip over as much. And then suddenly a word will pop out, and, it'll be bay, and you say, oh, yes, of course. Well, of course, they're on Biscayne Bay. Maybe that'll be useful. So you write that bay is a useful rhyme. And you make a list of rhymes that are in some way relevant to what you're trying to say, and then you use them.
The more you write, do you feel like you've used up rhymes? Can't use a rhyme you've already used to...
Well, that's certainly true of any kind of trick or...
Give me an example of the kind of trick rhyme you're talking about.
Oh, goodness. I don't know. Soul-stirring and bolstering in Follies, If you use that once, you don't use it again. Lottie-dottie and nobody. You don't use that more than once. Or if you do, you're a fool. And I probably have used it more than once, but I don't think so. So that's what I mean. Whereas, of course, you're always going to end up rhyming day and may and say over and over and over and over again, from song to song, show to show, because they're useful and they're words that have many meanings and many connotations. And So that's what I mean.
Stephen Sondheim, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure.
Stephen Sondheim recorded in 2010.
Here's to us.
Who's like us? Damn few. Hey, old friend, are you okay?
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.